News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the father of an Indian student murdered in Salford says he can't understand why he wasn't officially told about his son's death. Greater Manchester Police couldn't reach the family before a message was posted on Facebook. A £50,000 reward is being offered for the information about the Boxing Day shooting. Speaking from India, his father, Subhash Bidve, explains when he found out.
I came to know on 26th. Of December on a Boxing Day around 4:30 through somebody's Facebook network, and this has been very, very difficult to understand.
Three men have been charged with murder following the death of a 23-year-old man in Shrewsbury. Jason Cook was stabbed in the Monkmoor area of the town on Tuesday evening and died in hospital. More than 1,600 jobs are going at the struggling shoe chain Barrett's Priceless. Administrators have failed to find a buyer for the retailer's concessions, which are in stores like Dorothy Perkins and Outfits. The stock market has closed for the last time in 2011, ending one of the most eventful and painful years for the economy. More than £90 billion has been wiped off the value of the UK's leading shares in the past 12 months.
Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us discuss some of this week's news and review some of the big stories of 2011 and even 2012 is political economist Ponnie Winch. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we look back at some untold stories of 2011 and some favourite internet films. Plus, we look forward to the ominous year of 2012. With the announcement that the formula for a deadly form of flu could be published online by a Dutch lab, we look at the changing face of modern warfare and at the latest US hypersonic weapons, which can hit anywhere in the world in half an hour. Armed satellites designed to knock out enemy satellites. And can war be fought for our hearts and minds, that is, using TV, social networking and the now massive industry of public relations? Plus, the Armageddon scenario being contemplated in the Treasury right now. What could they be planning? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, cloudy with some light rain dying out. This weekend, Saturday is 11 Celsius, Sunday a bit cooler at 9 Celsius. Cloudy with light rain over the weekend. Next week, cloudy week with mostly dry. Seeing light rain on Tuesday, more rain possible on Wednesday and Thursday. Next weekend, 7th and 8th of January, that is, rain on Saturday, windy too on Sunday. Week after next, around 5 Celsius and no frost, rain on Tuesday night and Friday, windy on Wednesday and Friday. So not much joy there, but it's quite good that it's just above freezing, very little frost, hardly a winter at all really, but lots of cloud and wind and rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests. Joining me is a politics graduate with a Master's in International Political Economy, Polly Winch. Hi, Polly. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, can you give us your prognosis for next year? We continue to hear from Martin week after week here that this is terribly gloomy, there's going to be some sort of crash imminently on the horizon. What's your view of next year, with taking in mind the continuous, it seems, throughout 2011, these political summits that have been having, economic summits in Europe, which still haven't actually really reached a conclusion?
I suppose I take a bit more of an optimistic view than Martin does. I think we're at quite a historic moment, really. And I think that 2012 will present a moment of opportunity for people. I mean, you've already seen it beginning with the Occupy movements and the social unrest throughout Europe. I think that people might start to kind of reclaim a bit of the power that I think we've lost over the last 30 or 40 years.
Would you really compare the Occupy movement, the Occupy Wall Street, and say Occupy St Paul's in London and here in Bristol, with what's been going on in the Arab world? A lot of people are doing this. Do you think the two are really linked?
I think there's a difference, a big difference, between what's happening in the Middle East and the Occupy movements, to be honest. I mean, it's quite hard to decipher. There's for me, is quite a lot of mystery around both the Occupy movements and what's happening in the Middle East. Undoubtedly, you know, people are kind of getting together and voicing discontent, but I think there's still a lot to be unravelled before we can really analyse it and work out what's been going on.
Because one of the things is very, very different conditions people are in. I mean, people have got more freedom in this part of the world because basically there's more resources around, and they don't have quite such a desperately hard time. Although, of course, things are changing. The other thing is, I mean, how genuine do you think these occupations are? Because we're seeing some of them sort of fracturing for all sorts of reasons, for whatever, you know, sometimes due to things like alcohol and drugs and drink and this kind of thing. They're turning into sort of collections of the damaged in society, which is not really the best way to sort of grow a political movement.
No, I agree with you. It's interesting, the Occupy movements. I mean, I was helping out at Occupy Bristol for quite a while, and I read in the paper, you know, that the police had been scanning the tents to see whether people were actually in them, and they'd found that only 10% of the tents were occupied. And I thought, oh, well, you know, what nonsense kind of propaganda. And actually, my time in the Bristol one, I did actually start to think, well, perhaps a lot of those tents aren't occupied, you know, so that's strange.
Well, what the Occupy people will say is that in the cold weather, well, it's not quite so cold right now, but what happens is a lot of people come out of their tents, because in the autumn it wasn't so cold, and they come into a warm, heated building which has been built on College Green, because that's just going to keep them warmer overnight.
Sure. How do you mean a warm...
Well, because they built a kind of structure and they've got a little burner in there with wood, a wood-fired stove. I mean, certainly if it was me, I'd rather be sleeping in a warm, you know, even a sort of shanty town kind of affair than a freezing cold tent.
Well, you've got 60 tents and you haven't got 60 people in those shacks.
Well, we shall see also, of course, after the holiday, how many people come back, because for a lot of people, they will go back to their families over the Christmas period, and then, or maybe, you know, then they'll be back, I suppose, in January.
Well, perhaps, if they were there in the first place.
And what about the object of all this? I mean, because you were producing a news digest, which was, I suppose, pulling apart some of the more interesting financial or you know, social stories. And did you get a feeling that there was a specific aim of Occupy Bristol as when you were part of it?
Definitely not, no. I'm still trying to work out what the aim is, and I'm sure that the people down there...
Okay, Polly, I'll put it to you that they did have an aim, and that was that they wanted the rich and the big corporations to pay more tax.
Yeah, I think that was part of it, but I don't think that was very, perhaps, articulated as well as it could have been. I mean, if I'm down there and I'm not even really sure what the aim is, then I think that says a lot.
OK, Polly, thanks. We're also joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, I want to ask you this week about the exercise that's been going on in the Straits of Hormuz. First of all, whereabouts is the Straits of Hormuz, and why is it such an important sea lane?
Well, it's the choke point for most of the world's oil supplies. And it's between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states.
And it sort of leads up to the Suez Canal, am I right?
No, the Suez Canal.
That's around
the
corner. That's around the corner, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of oil comes down out through the Gulf, and the Iranian general staff this week have been having an exercise claiming that they might be able to close the Gulf down, because the sanctions are about to be put on Iran, supposedly because of their nuclear ambitions, although the IEA has said that they haven't actually got any nuclear weapons or a nuclear weapons program, but all of the candidates in the US presidential election are acting as if they did, and they're actually because of the election campaign in the US, they are rattling up the rhetoric. And it's very, very dangerous saber-rattling going on, in my view. Very dangerous.
But, I mean, both sides are doing it. Both sides are doing it, surely.
Well, the Iranians, basically, are saying, look, you can't put sanctions on... You know, if you put sanctions on us, we'll put sanctions on you. We'll stop the oil coming out of the Gulf. But they've backed off from that, because, of course, it's a suicide option.
But isn't there a sort of cheeky element in the Western hierarchy that says, well, actually, this is great for us, because it will send oil prices through the roof?
The oil prices bumped up as a result of the threat, and then they went down again, because it was clear that the Iranians were not actually going to carry it out, because it would have led straight to a confrontation with the US.
But they are fleet. Having their exercise. I mean, I've seen footage.
Oh, yes, they're an exercise, but they're not actually interdicting any vessels.
So the missiles that are going out of these Iranian ships are going over the top of the oil.
Well, they're
tankers,
not firing missiles, except to virtually. I mean, what the Iranian battle plan is, as far as I can see, is in order to protect various convoys that are going up and down the Gulf, and also to keep the supply lines open to Iraq when the military was still in there, and there's still quite a lot of mercenaries and so on there, the US Fifth Fleet is based in Bahrain. Now, if they want to attack Iran, what they need to do is withdraw all of their fleet from the Gulf and put it into them into the Indian Ocean, and then use Diego Garcia. So Britain will have a role in this. I understand that the Conservatives have already agreed with the Americans that they can use Diego Garcia.
So this is a little island, a bit like the Falklands.
Yes,
Britain owns, and they kicked the locals off.
The Chagos Islanders were kicked off, and they've been struggling to go back. So Britain basically dispossessed the inhabitants and handed it over to the Americans as an unsinkable aircraft carrier. So they need to launch their attack from around there, because in that way they will avoid the Iranians being able to carry out countermeasures. But the problem for the Western powers is if they withdraw their ships from the Gulf in order to attack Iran, Iran will immediately see what's happening and will then draw the correct conclusion that they're about to be attacked. So in order to get the element of tactical surprise, they've got to keep the ships in the Gulf. Now, that means that the Iranians' calculation is that they've got lots and lots of Russian and Chinese anti-ship missiles, and they are hoping to turn the Gulf into a killing ground for aircraft carriers and other big ships.
But that's going to work against them in the international press, isn't it? If all of these ships are seen to be being picked off by the Iranians.
Well, no. I mean, if the Iranians are attacked first, they will say it's self-defence, and they will be right. And the Russian and Chinese general staffs will stand back and watch this, because they've been developing these missiles for years, because they know they can't compete with the West in terms of naval technology. The Chinese, for example, have just bought their very first aircraft carrier, and the Americans have got something like 30 or 40 aircraft carriers, and nobody else has got more than two. We've got one with no planes on. But the thing is that these aircraft carriers could be fantastically vulnerable to these missiles, and the Russians and the Chinese have developed these missiles over the last generation because they knew they were never going to compete in terms of aircraft carriers. I mean, the Russians have got a couple, but they've spent a lot of money on these missiles, and I understand that these missiles are very good and that they're quite likely to succeed. But and if you think about taking down two aircraft carriers, that's what, 30,000 people on each one? That'd be 60,000 casualties. Nobody will get off alive if they sink an aircraft carrier.
This exercise by the Iranians is a reaction to a certain extent to the sanctions that have been put on Iran over this IA, International Atomic Energy Authority report. Are the Iranians, do you think, looking at the German euro position and the situation in Europe with the euro? Is there a connection there?
Well, everybody's watching everything, obviously. I mean, it's a very, very tense moment, and everything interacts on everything else. I mean, Polly here is a political economist. Politics affects the economy, and vice versa. I mean, for example, if the Straits of Hormuz was closed and there was a huge fight in the Gulf, the oil price would go rocketing through the roof, and the banks will definitely collapse.
That's right. I mean, actually, you know, for a lot of people who are into these sort of derivatives markets, they'll be looking at this thinking, hey, you know, I'm going to bet that in 6 months' time the oil price is three times, four times what it
is now.
Well,
that's right. And, of course, the studies have been done of the US Congress, which have shown that their share portfolios consistently outperform ordinary people's share portfolios, and that's because they know when things are going to happen, and they phone their dealers and say, look, will you just buy or sell something for me?
They've got these financial instruments called catastrophe bonds, and they're designed explicitly for these kind of black swan moments. Yeah. And like you say, if you know it's going to happen in advance, then you buy lots of these catastrophe bonds for this, you know, particular catastrophe and make loads of money out of it.
Yeah, I mean, what will happen is that there will be a massive concentration of wealth in the hands of the big players in the financial system, and everybody else will lose everything. And I can't quite get my head around where they're going to keep all this money with all the banks collapsed. So it may be that in actual fact it's an own goal, because, you know, if the banks collapse with the money in, then you haven't got money anyway. It's only electronic signals in any case.
I mean, if you've got foreknowledge of some kind of disaster, surely the thing to do is to let people know there's going to be a disaster rather than to bet on it and make money out of it.
Well, the CIA's got Promise software, which tries to look at share movements in real time so that they can see because it's a way of gathering intelligence. And if you remember on 9/11, the two airplane companies that were involved were heavily shorted in the week before the attack, and at the time they said, oh, this is clear evidence that somebody knew it was going to happen, and they said it must be bin Laden. But when they investigated it, it led back to a guy called Buzzy Krongard, who's former executive director of the CIA and head of Deutsche Bank, and then they stopped talking about it. I think that's fairly clear evidence that it was an inside job, because you just got to follow the money. And then, you know, there we are.
Okay, now into our first story this week. A care for the elderly, this is in Wednesday's Guardian, is an absolute crisis, warns a charity. Britain faces an absolute crisis in social care for elderly people as a result of cuts to services, the director of the country's leading charity for older people has warned. Michelle Mitchell's the director of Age UK. She said increasing numbers of older people with considerable care needs were getting absolutely no support at all, or poor quality and limited support as a result of cuts to local authority provision. She cited research by the King's Fund showing that the number of older people who needed significant care support but received no assistance will reach nearly 900,000 in 2012, rising to a million by 2015. This means people will deteriorate more quickly and go into hospital, she said. We've seen the rates of admissions to hospital increase over the last few months, which, apart from anything else, is very expensive to have someone admitted through A&E and then kept in hospital. Care is in crisis and it's getting worse. We've evidence to show local authorities have cut care for older people by 4.5% this year. This is at a time when social care is chronically underfunded anyway. She cited cases in which older people who were unable to undress themselves were being put to bed at 5 p.m. because it was the only time care workers could fit them in, and left until 10 a.m. the next day. This is pretty shocking, Polly. What are your thoughts about this and how it fits into the bigger picture?
I mean, it's just awful. And what I find difficult to believe or to understand is the fact that the government is doing this when we've got these huge bailouts, supposedly, of the bank, you know, running into billions and billions, I mean, far more than the cuts to welfare, and that this is being allowed to go on. You know, it's awful. I was watching something on the news the other day about the increase in the number of families and people having to go to food banks, you know, and these aren't people, you know, people with jobs, or, you know, they just don't have enough money. Like, inflation, or basically the price of everything, is going up. And so you've got, you know, the elderly and disabled people, and then just, you know, people with lower incomes totally unable to cope, and the government doesn't seem to be doing anything about it.
Martin, we've had quantitative easing, well, QE1 last year and QE2 this year. QE1 was £200 billion. QE2 was £75 billion. That all went basically to the banks to buy off bad debt for the banks, and it's going in sort of trickles, this latest 75 billion. But I got my calculator out, and that is around about £4,230 per man, woman and child in the UK, the entire figure. And the QE2, the latest one from November this year, is £1,000 each per person. Now, I can't understand why it makes any sense to give these dead and dying banks this money, rather than actually to just simply give it to the people in Britain that they could then spend and, you know, get themselves out of some of these difficult situations. A lot of that, of course, would go into the local authority coffers as well, and they could spend properly on elderly people's care.
Well, exactly. I think the solution to the crisis is to decide what you want to do. For example, what would an elderly care system that you really wanted look like? How many people would it employ? How much would it cost? And you do the same with everything else, and then you'd find the money to do it. You either find it through some deficit financing is necessary. You don't want to be running a balanced budget in a situation like this. But obviously you can't just print the money. But what they're doing now is printing the money just to keep the banks afloat, as you've suggested. And this is just insane. We've had 4 years where the politicians basically have just done everything that the bankers have wanted, and they've not asked for anything in return, apart from vague lectures about how they ought to lend to small businesses. And the banks quite rightly say, well, what's the point of lending to small businesses in a situation like this? They're all going to go bust. And they're right. There's no point. So what they're doing is just taking the money and running, and we're giving it to them. So at a certain point, people are going to get angry about this.
So, I mean, I'm getting a little bit angry here, actually. Polly, what are your thoughts about this? Am I stupid? Am I really stupid in thinking that this money could actually just be simply given to ordinary people and to local authorities in order to keep the economy going, rather than just simply to the banks? This total of £275 billion, which has been used as quantitative easing, printing money.
Oh, well, I don't see why, if you're... Well, printing the money, although I'm not sure that that's what quantitative easing is, literally. As I understand it, it's, well, buying the bonds of As I understand it, sorry, Martin, you take.
No, they're buying the bonds of the banks, basically. So in other words, they're picking up their bad debts effectively, and then the money is never seen again. Because of course, all that happens is that various people get, you know, the bad debts get offloaded, and that's the end of that, you know.
So it doesn't really necessarily encourage the banks to do it better next time, does it?
No, because they're being rewarded for failure. And what we've got here is Milton Friedman would have pointed out that what happens when you subsidise an industry like the banking industry is that they keep coming back for more. And of course, Milton Friedman was originally talking about things like, you know, car industries or coal industries, but the banking industry has been a classic example of this, where they give them money, they spend it, and then they come back for more, and that's an endless process. You're never going to be able to. These debts are unpayable, and that should be the basic consideration that people should be looking at. But they're not. They're literally looting what's left of the economy, and when it crashes, as it will crash in my view, then people are going to be mad. What's very disappointing to me was to see how well Cameron is doing in the opinion polls, despite the fact that he's made a complete hash of the economy.
Well, isn't that only because Ed Miliband is doing so spectacularly badly? I mean, his New Year message, and I've got a copy of the I newspaper here from, I think this is Thursday's, page 11. Miliband tells party faithful, don't despair. Now, that isn't really much of a galvanising message, don't despair, is it?
No. But on the other hand, I don't think it would make any difference if we had a different leader. What you've got to accept is that conservatism, with a small and a large C, is a very, very important cultural influence in this country and always has been. The electorate, by and large, especially the middle section of it, have bought into the idea that some kind of cuts are necessary. And the Labour Party has backed itself into a corner where they agreed with cuts, and therefore they're not really in a position to argue. And there's no real coherent alternative being put before the people. And I don't think any coherent alternative will emerge until there has been a crash.
Polly, what's your coherent alternative, if you have one?
I think the first thing to do would be to take heed of what Martin said before about the debts are unpayable, and wipe off a lot of the debt. I mean, that's what's happened. There was a book, The Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and he talks about that. Basically, the debt gets to such a point where it's completely unsustainable. When you have to kind of wipe the slate clean to a certain extent. So I think you start with that.
But isn't that going to be a bit of a disaster? Because as soon as debts are not paid, that just causes a cataclysm in the markets. And out there, the bond markets just hate it. They hate it.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you see, that if you carry on trying to pretend you're going to pay them, eventually you run up against a crash. That is the market solution. Unpayable debts are liquidated in a crash.
So it sounds to me like you've got a sort of threat coming from the markets, like you've got to keep paying your debt or else. And on the other hand, you've got all the sort of austerity disaster. And at some point, the austerity becomes worse than the threats than the markets.
Well, if what they were doing, for example, in bailing out Greece and Spain and so on, and they were actually saying, right, we want you to spend more, not austerity, then there might be some sense in what they're trying to do. But to insist that they've got to pay all of their debts and that they've got to do it through austerity is a guaranteed recipe for an explosion in public deficits. And that will happen in Britain as well. No matter how appealing Cameron may appear to middle-class voters at the moment, when it becomes clear that the deficit is actually exponentially increasing as a result of the policies being pursued, then I think people will wake up, but only then.
Now, David Cameron isn't running the country alone. He's in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, and their leader, Nick Clegg, came out with a New Year's message on YouTube a couple of days ago. So let's have a listen to a bit of that.
What we're doing as a party and as a coalition, it's not easy, but it's right. We're putting the interests of the country first, and we've taken the first steps towards building a fairer, greener, and more liberal country. We have worked flat out to restore confidence in the economy and started to transform Britain for the better. It's an ambition of which we should be proud. There are no easy years when you're in government, and we've had to show real strength in 2011. The next year will be one that poses many great challenges for everyone in Britain. But I know we must continue to do what's right for our country. And with that, I wish you all a very happy new year.
Yes, there's a few titters going around the studio here. Now, I wonder if you can tell that he used to be a public relations consultant. Martin.
Well, yes. He sounds like a public relations consultant, doesn't he?
He's actually saying there, fairer, greener and more liberal Britain. I mean, surely that's a good thing.
I think many people in his own party would question that. I mean, we had John Keely on here the other week and he was saying that he felt that Nick Clegg was becoming an electoral liability to his own party. I mean, we didn't encourage him to say that. He came straight out with it. I think the Liberal Party actually is split. I think people like Steve Webb, who used to be my MP out in South Gloss, are very much basically left of centre people, and other people like Nick Clegg are basically right of centre people, and I think that they've found themselves cruelly torn between those two poles, and I think ultimately I would see a coalition between the Labour Party and what I would regard as the good elements of the Liberal Democrat Party. I mean, we nearly got that in the election. If we'd had a PR election, that would have been the logical choice. If you tallied up the votes under a PR system, it would have been a Liberal-Labour coalition, and we'd been in a different place than the one we are today.
Polly, do you buy it? Do you buy Nick Clegg and his vision for the future and his New Year good wishes?
No. To be honest, I'm so bored of these sort of vacuous sound bites. I mean, anyone can say greener, fairer, more liberal, look what we're doing, it's best for the country, but you actually have to do these things, and that's what's important. You know, I think people are judged by their actions, really, not what they say. And you know, I heard Ed Miliband as well the other day saying something equally vacuous, and I just think, I don't know, they need to pull their finger out, really. And you can't say this is a more liberal country unless you're actually passing laws which do increase civil liberties. The same goes for green policies and, you know, kind of equality, and it's rubbish. It really is rubbish.
So is there a bit of a crisis in political leadership at the moment, do you think?
Yes,
both of you?
Definitely.
Why is that?
I think part of the problem, and it's even more noticeable in the United States, is that political leaders have two constituencies. One is the people who vote for them, and the other is the people who fund their campaigns. And I think we're having an object lesson in who the senior partner is. It's the people who put the money up who decide the policies, and they decide the terms of the debate. So the debate in this country is all about how to cut public expenditure. Nobody's actually... I mean, I think the case is, there's a case here for increasing public expenditure. Not, I mean, we must have this case of the care for the elderly in a shambles. Well, what you do is you get your finger out and you sort it out, and that costs money. And you say, look, what kind of society do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a society where people are put to bed at 5 o'clock and then left till 10 o'clock the next morning? Or do we want a society where people are properly looked after? And if you put it like that, people, the problem that the left has got is that many of our natural constituency, who are the poor and the underprivileged, are so alienated from politics that they don't vote at all. And we have a real problem getting them out. In Bristol, we had a by-election in Southmead, which I worked on last year, this year, and the turnout was miserably poor, miserably poor. And of course, in middle class areas, and you know, like Clifton and further on up the hill, people do vote. They understand the purpose of it, and they queue up outside the polling stations to make sure that their voices are heard. The poor and the underprivileged, sadly, often lacking in education, don't really understand the significance or the importance of it, sadly.
But perhaps also lacking in a real choice, you know. Indeed. Like you were saying before. Oh, yes. I mean, what's the point of voting if you're voting, you know, it doesn't matter whether you vote for Labour, Lib Dem or Conservative, because the same thing's going to happen anyway.
So Polly, how do we inject a little bit of reality and a bit of vision into our political leadership?
I think there needs to be a complete overhaul, and I don't think, well, because there is no choice, and because no real choice, and because it doesn't matter who you vote for, I don't know whether we need, you know, a totally new party, or, I mean, something needs to give, really, and we need to have alternative opinions and alternative voices being heard. But at the moment, it's just the same class of people saying the same thing, giving the same, you know, rubbish options, and I think, yeah, there just needs to be a dramatic overhaul of politics in Westminster.
Can I just add one of the positive things which has happened in this last year, is that all of the prime ministers and deputy prime ministers of the three devolved assemblies, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, have all signed a joint statement opposing coalition cuts policy. And the most significant part of that, so that's the SNP, Plaid Cymru, Labour, Sinn Féin and the SDLP, and most significantly of all, the Democratic Unionist Party, Ian Paisley's party, has come out against the cuts. And as I said to John Keely last week, as he's a Liberal, how comfortable are you, John, with the Democratic Unionist Party and Ian Paisley standing to your left? And I think it's a big change for them. because the Unionist Party, the Ulster Unionist Party, was very, very closely associated with the Conservative Party.
Do you see some cracking in this so-called consensus for cuts then?
Well, yes, because you can see that there's a clear consensus in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland that they don't want the policy, and they've actually got some means to make themselves heard. And of course, they've got PR elections in all of those three assemblies. And if you've got PR, then you can actually have a variety of voices. This is what pushes, because we've got a first-past-the-post system, all three major party leaders are trying to capture the same swing voters in the outer London suburbs.
Okay.
And so that's why they all say the same things.
Well, one casualty of the cuts is a certain Edward Heal. He's a soldier, and concerned residents are calling for streetlights to be switched back on in a Clevedon street where a soldier was killed on Christmas Day. Edward Heal, a trooper in the King's Royal Hussars, was in collision with a Mazda car at Ken Road around 1:15 a.m. I imagine 15 minutes after the lights were switched off. A 19-year-old tank gunner had been training for a tour of duty in Afghanistan starting in March, been out for a drink with his stepbrother Sam at the Bristol pub, and was understood to be on his way home when the accident happened. Street lights along part of Ken Road, including the section where the accident happened, are turned off between midnight and 5 a.m. by North Somerset Council in a money-saving move decided earlier this year. The authority plans to turn off 18,600 streetlights across the district by 2014 to save £115,000 a year in electricity costs. Circumstances surrounding the accident are being investigated by police. Now, Martin, this does seem a little bit silly, doesn't it, to be switching off streetlights in what sounds here like a residential area at midnight. I mean, you've got actually, since pub opening hours have now been extended over the last 10 years, it means people are actually going to be wandering around drunk at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning. And this seems like a bit of a false economy.
Well, if you think they're saving £115,000, just think what the cost, not just the human cost. This soldier has been trained at God knows what price to drive a tank, and now they've lost it for saving £115,000. And it's just, you know, even that one death probably makes it a false economy.
I mean,
of course, if there are any more deaths, it really will get silly, won't it?
I've been around the valleys, for example, a lot of places around there, midnight, the lights probably just get switched off, the street lights all go off. Was driving along one evening and suddenly all the lights just went off. This sounds, I mean, it's a bit third world, isn't it?
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, we're meant to kind of progress, I suppose, as time goes on, and it feels like we're going backwards. I mean, this is surely something that probably used to happen in Victorian times. I mean, when the flames blew out.
Yes, probably, yeah. The other thing is that there's a different regime to maintain these streetlights. So when the bulbs go, you know, they wait for ages and ages and ages before they put them back again. It seems like all of our infrastructure is slowly crumbling.
Yeah, we saw something very similar happen in the former Soviet Union when I used to work over there, and people were actually stripping to get the metal out of electricity pylons and stuff like this. So the whole infrastructure of the country was being cannibalised for scrap.
Well, we've had the same thing going on with copper on the railway lines, haven't we? With massive delays on the railway because people are turning up in the middle of the night and taking the copper to sell to scrap merchants.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, coming back to the earlier story about the elderly care, in the Soviet Union, during the transition process, you know, to capitalist market economics, the death rate shot up. Absolutely shot up. And of course the calculation was that the sooner these people die the better, because then they'll get them out of the way instead of having to pay pensions to them. And it made me cry when I saw these old people, because many of them had fought in the Second World War, they'd lived under Stalin, they'd survived Hitler, and now they're just going to be starved to death by liberal capitalism at the end of their lives.
But it seems to me that we're in a situation where what used to be a country is being turned into a company, and various bits of that company which don't make money are just being sort of forgotten about and shelved.
Well, that's why the communists did so well in the Russian election. I mean, but Putin's party lost a lot of seats, and they came down from having two-thirds of the seats to a substantially reduced number. But all of their votes went to the communists, and they took 20% of the vote. And I can see a future in which, you know, Putin will be edged out possibly, but by Gennady Zyuganov and the Communist Party, especially if the economy tanks out. But whether Putin will go quietly is another matter.
Do you think it's an argument, though, that, well, I'm just saying here, trying to plow my own little furrow here, saying that essentially this idea of business and business management, these kind of management schools, these kinds of people are now seem to be those sorts of values which now seem to be running our economy?
Well, I think the technical term for it is the market state. And we've moved away from having a welfare state to having a market state. And that would be okay, I suppose, if the market was actually functional, but it's not. So we're actually putting all of our eggs in one basket and then dropping them.
Well, let's turn to Greece now. And this is news from Wednesday this week, from the English language, or actually it may even be Greek language, London Greek News. The government's scrambled on Thursday to defuse a political furore sparked by the resignation of two financial crime prosecutors who cited state interference with their high-profile investigations. In their resignation letter, the officials noted they'd accepted their appointment as chief economic and taxation crime investigators at the end of March, with a deep sense of duty and motivation to contribute to the common good, despite a negative climate and in full knowledge of the peculiar relation between contemporary Greek society and the fast-evolving phenomenon of financial crime. But the government, they complained, had not only deprived their office of rudimentary administrative support and computer terminals, but a new bill uses false pretexts and unfound arguments, reasons for attempting to replace us and get rid of our presence. They're working on several cases. Some of the high-profile cases which Peponis's office was investigating includes the resignation of former Secretary-General in charge of the Finance Ministry's information system, who accused financial crime squad officials of blocking the collection of heavy fines on fuel market racketeers, as well as his revelations about tax inspectors pocketing 40% of every fine that results from their audit. And there's a whole list of the different cases they're going against. Another one is an investment by social security funds at high-risk structured bonds, which costs the funds several million euros in losses and kickbacks to fund officials and intermediaries. I mean, it sounds like there's a real culture of criminality, particularly to do with tax collection in Greece. These guys have been charged, Martin, with investigating it, and now they've said that we can't actually do our job, so we're resigning. There's no point in us carrying on.
Yes, it's a very sad situation. I mean, all of the southern European countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain, and to a certain extent Italy, they had a history of being run by fascist dictatorships, and the tax laws were framed during that period. And basically, wealthy people in those countries do not feel that they have to pay taxes, and they've got used to the idea that they don't. And you know, when we talk in this country about raising taxes on the rich, they just say, we'll just go offshore. And of course, that is the problem. Even if you try to raise taxes on people, you know, where they really they do owe them and they should pay them, they're in a position to basically thwart this. And ultimately, as I say, people are going to get angry about this. You know, but perhaps the family of this soldier who's just been run over because of a stupid decision to try and save a few bob. Those are the kind of people who are eventually going to get very, very annoyed.
Polly, these two prosecutors, Greek prosecutors, Grigoris Peponis and his deputy Spyros Mouzakis, is that right? Mouzakis. These two, they've been charged with quite an important job, which is putting in jail some of the biggest criminals in Greece. And now they said, well, we simply can't do our job.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the interesting thing about this for me is the fact that at least Greece has these people. I mean, at least it's thinking along the right lines. We have nothing like this whatsoever. I mean, we have the National Audit Office, which literally doesn't audit anything. If you look into their report on the failure of Northern Rock, it's actually laughable. I mean, they don't even look at the balance sheet. If you're not auditing the balance sheet and looking at what's gone on, then I don't even know what you're there for, really. So, I mean, yes, it's sad that they've had to resign and that, you know, they're having difficulties doing their job. But at least Greece is on the beginning of the right tracks by even having these people and recognising that there needs to be investigations into financial crime, which is just something that the UK has yet to materialise.
You know, the reason why? It's because it's so endemic that serious people who've looked into it said, well, we'll have to probably arrest everybody. And, of course, that is unthinkable. Therefore, they don't arrest anybody. But ultimately, a tax official basically earns their own salary in what they do many times over.
You're talking about kickbacks, basically.
Well, no. Every time a tax official is paid, I don't know, say 30 grand, but that tax official will bring in for the government hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds. So there's it's absolutely self-financing. But the tax office here has been cut back as a part of, you know, austerity measures. Now, what we really ought to do is actually soup these tax officials up, employ a whole new load of people to go chasing after this money and insist on getting it, and it would pay for itself. It's not an expenditure. It would pay for itself. But they don't want to do it because basically the government including the Liberal Democrats, represents the wealthy classes. It does. There are 17 millionaires in the cabinet, and they're not interested in tax evasion.
And I think, one of the great problems you've just highlighted is the fact that we've got this kind of two-tier legal system. You know, you've said, like, it's unthinkable that they just arrest everybody, but then it's not unthinkable that they arrest everybody that was involved in the riots and nicked a pair of trainers. You know, it's just like one rule for one and another rule for another, and that's something that really needs to be addressed.
So I guess they've got to start at the top, really. And so is this sort of Goldman Sachs types or where?
Well, as I say, I think probably virtually all of what's been going on in the financial markets is technically illegal. So that means you'd have to arrest everybody. Now, at the moment, that's an unthinkable thing. But once the economy's crashed and people are in the streets, it won't be an unthinkable thing. And, of course, the real danger is, not just in this country, but in many other countries, this is a potentially recipe for civil war, basically.
But, I mean, if I was one of the directors of Goldman Sachs and I'd been up to no good, I would be wanting to make sure that the potential police who might be coming to arrest me would be being paid off too, so they wouldn't do. This is a sort of mafia-style tactic.
Yes. Basically, so that's right.
We shall see. Maybe some arrests in 2012. Who knows? I mean, there was actually one arrest, wasn't there, last year, of one of the Goldman Sachs officials who was a sort of lowly chap.
They pick a few scapegoats just to keep the thing. But, I mean, in the 1980s, when the savings and loans scandal, which was the Reagan era's bubble bursting, something like 3,000 people were sent to prison. And as you said last week, Polly, it doesn't deter financial fraudsters to find them, because it's just a cost of doing business. You have to send them to prison, because that's the only way to deter them.
Okay, now, before we go look at the US elections coming up, shocking figures show teenagers have a quarter of abortions in Britain. Nearly a quarter of all abortions in Britain are carried out on girls under the age of 20, a major report's revealed. The shocking figures compiled by the EU show British teenagers are far more likely than average European youngsters to have a termination. Those who compiled the report called for greater access to contraception, youth-friendly sexual health services, and better sex education in schools. But others said such lessons given to children as young as 5 are clearly not working. They blamed a disproportionate number of teen abortions in the UK on a lack of independent counselling. The data compiled by Reprostat Group, the EU's community health monitoring programme, details abortion figures across the region. Well, apparently this, Martin, is the worst. We're the worst in Europe for teenage abortions, other than Belgium. So why is that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't like to speculate about all of the factors involved. It's a very sad statistic. You'd like to think that British young people had some sense about these things, but I'm afraid clearly not. You know, it's not as if contraception is not available. It is available, but people just aren't using it. And, of course, with the threat of sexually transmitted diseases and so on, people really ought to think twice before they do what they do. But, I mean, it's a very sad figure. I mean, we've got a kind of hopeless underclass developing in this country, which is similar to what you've got in the US. I'll tell you where it's probably worse than Britain. It's probably in the US. They've got the worst statistics for most of these things. And it's because people basically are not given the tools to have a decent life. They struggle in dysfunctional communities at the bottom of the pile, you know, the opportunities are missing. And you know, I mean, I saw a programme about Kerala the other day in India, which has been run by the Communist Party of India for the last 40, 50 years. And most families there have one child each, just one. And it's all done on a voluntary basis. And their social stats make ours look positively medieval. But they're a very poor place, but they managed to do it.
Polly, this is a little bit of an indictment on Britain, isn't it? And it's, you know, it looks like our figures are a bit medieval, with so many of these girls under the age of 20 having abortions. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I mean, the article is about the high rate of abortion, not necessarily pregnancy itself. So perhaps that shows quite a lot of liberalism within the UK about, you know, it being acceptable for young women to have that choice themselves, and I think that that's actually a good thing.
Why do you think this is happening in the first place here, and what do you think? I mean, you know, one of the things that comes to mind for me is actually quite a lot of peer pressure on young people under 20 to be having sex, but maybe it's not the most important, you know, it's not the most appropriate thing to be doing. It's almost a sort of seen as something to do for fun rather than to start a family.
Well, it's definitely a cultural thing. I mean, I remember when I was at school, girls, you know, it wouldn't be uncommon for kind of 11, 12-year-olds to be losing your virginity at that kind of age and, you know, for there to be pressure, yeah, peer pressure, because that was the cool thing to do. The same goes for drinking and smoking. And, you know, I think that says, kind of relates to what Martin was saying about the lack of opportunities, and there's naturally not a lot for young people to do. So you go to the park, have some cider, you know, have a fumble in the dark, and, you know, unless we start to provide services for young people that offer the kinds of things that they want to do, then, you know, I think that's going to happen.
Do you think, I mean, as a young person yourself, do you think that there is a sort of resentment from the youth looking to the older generation? I mean, I know quite a lot of older people who their attitude is, oh, these damn young people, why don't they just go out and get a job? What they don't necessarily realise is that the job market is very different to when they were young people.
Absolutely. And I mean, you have to have a degree to like work in a shop now, you know. It's kind of these lots of young people, there are absolutely no opportunities, and I really dislike this kind of demonization of young people, you know, and I don't think that the government does anything to help that really, and I think the media has a lot to answer for in that respect as well. And then, I mean, perhaps you get a certain, you know, it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If nothing's expected of you, then, you know, you kind of go and you are being hopeless.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's very sad that so many young people in our society have no hope, no future. A million under the age of 24 unemployed, and as things stand, I think most of those people probably will never work, will never get a stable family life for themselves. And it's a tragedy and a scandal. And I think the Occupy movement, we were talking earlier about the kind of people that are going to Occupy, and some of them are homeless and what have you. I don't think that's necessarily a problem. I think, you know, educated people like yourself are involved, and homeless people. Why not? That's social solidarity, isn't it?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, if the homeless people, those will be the homeless people that will have kept it going over Christmas, good for them. And it's a part of, you know, why should the homeless be excluded from things? Why should they be, you know, treated as less than they are? And I've been homeless in the past. It's no fun at all, I can tell you. One of the things that's worst about it is you lose all your friends because you go and sleep on their sofas, they get fed up with you, and you go through a whole process of losing your friends. It's a very, very nasty process, and I've got great sympathy for those who find themselves on that situation.
Okay, moving over to the US now, and we've got the prospect of elections looming again over there, whether Obama is going to make it in to be president for a second term is definitely up for grabs. Now, we've got a clip now from up-and-coming Ron Paul. He's one of the front-runners now for the Republican candidacy in the US elections, and he gave a speech in Iowa yesterday to a rally of American Forces veterans. So let's have a listen to this guy, Ron Paul.
Early this year, the president announced a policy change. He said now that it was proper for him to have the authority to assassinate an American citizen, even if they have not been charged with anything, if he thought it was necessary. Very bad. Now, of course, the person they picked out, probably a very bad guy. He talked about stirring up violence. He was never charged with it. He never had a trial. And yet it was decided that he would be assassinated. So we used a drone and we assassinated him in Yemen. So let it go by. He's a bad guy. He's gone. But the president is very, very dangerous. So the next week, they decided, well, his son looked like a pretty shady character too. So they sent another missile over to get the son. Well, they got him, plus his cousin. They were back in the backyard barbecuing, killed them both. The son was 16 years old. And this is not the way America's supposed to be. We're supposed to be a nation of law. A rule of law is what we want. So, in one sense, when we go into the military, we take the oath and we go and fight and endanger ourselves to protect our Constitution. At the same time, our Constitution is being eroded right here at home. Just this last week, 2 weeks ago, I guess, the National Defense Authorization Act. That act has in it. I'm always impressed that so many people know about it. That means we have a healthy society and the internet is working. But that bill essentially eliminates posse comitatus. It's institutionalizing military law that the military can arrest a American citizen without charges and being denied an attorney and held indefinitely, even in a foreign prison.
That was Ron Paul speaking yesterday in Iowa to a rally of military US military veterans. Now, Martin, is he someone we should be watching in 2012?
I think he's a very interesting character. I think he's clearly a man of principle. I don't actually agree with everything that he says. I think his economics are basically flawed. But he's very sound on things like civil liberties and human rights. And one of the things that has given me great encouragement over the decades since 9/11 is that people on the right wing of American politics are not all idiots. And he's not an idiot. He's a good man.
Polly, what are your thoughts about this possible bit of a political revival in the US? Someone sounds a little bit different to the previous lot.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting, and most importantly, I think it's absolutely time. You know, what's been going on, well, I'd like to say just in the United States, but here as well, with the anti-terrorism laws being passed, is just, you know, unbelievable, really. And I think it's great that you've got people like Ron Paul standing up and talking about it. And like you said, Martin, you know, the fact, and I think this is perhaps where the right and the left might be able to come together and really kind of fight over a common cause, and that is freedom. I mean, you know, what's the point in fighting these wars if, you know, and kind of maintaining our countries if our traditions don't kind of survive with it, you know?
Well, this is the argument, isn't it? They're saying that we're fighting these wars to preserve our liberties. These people might come over and take them away, etc. But actually, they're being taken away by the very people who are doing the fighting, supposedly.
Well, absolutely. I think the biggest threat to our freedoms are our own governments at the moment, sadly enough.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was an interesting suggestion that Ron Paul may run with Denis Kucinich as his vice presidential candidate, who's a Democrat, a left-wing Democrat. Now, that would be interesting, because that would put the frighteners on Obama. But, of course, they would have to agree about the economic policy, and that might be a bit tricky. But the other thing I'd like to say about this assassination in Yemen that he was mentioning in there, these people are all involved with something called Al-Qaeda in the Iranian Peninsula. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, sorry. And we've got evidence to suggest that this is an entirely fabricated group. The two guys who set it up were in Guantanamo Bay, were released, and then went straight to Yemen to set this group up, which then gave the Americans the excuse to start bombing. And I don't necessarily believe that these people have been killed by drone strikes. That's what the American government says. But do believe them? I don't believe a word they say about anything.
Well, while we're in that part of the world, the Free Syrian Army apparently is commanded by the military governor of Tripoli. This is on the Voltaire Network website. Thierry Masson has been taking a great deal of interest in the struggles in Libya and now also in Syria. For the past week, the Spanish royalist newspaper, the ABC, has published a daily report by photographer Daniel Iriarte. The journalist is in with the Free Syrian Army in the north of the country, right on the Turkish border. Now, the first person he came across was Al-Mahdi Hattari, a Libyan who lived in Ireland before joining Al-Qaeda. At the end of the Libyan war, he was named commander of the Tripoli Brigade, then number two of the Tripoli Military Council, headed by Abdel Hakim Belaj. He resigned from this function, according to some, because of the dispute with the Transitional National Council, according to others, because he wanted to go back to Ireland to join his Irish wife. The truth is that he's actually headed for Syria. Martin, this is bizarre, isn't it, that the head of the Free Syrian Army has actually spent a lot of his life in Ireland and actually used to be the military governor of Tripoli. So what is going on?
Yeah, he's probably part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was basically the Libyan chapter of Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Qaeda, insofar as it exists at all, as almost entirely a creation of the Western intelligence services. So, as I mentioned earlier, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula looks entirely fabricated organisation, fabricated by the Western intelligence services. And it wouldn't surprise me at all. I was on a demonstration in London about the war in Afghanistan, and some guy came out of a pub and said, "Yeah, but what about Islamic extremism?" And I said, "Yes, the RAF have just bombed the Islamic Fighting Group to power in Libya. What are you talking about? They are our allies. They always were." Al-Qaeda is infiltrated into, for example, the Palestinian intelligence services when it were in Gaza, arrested an Al-Qaeda cell inside Gaza, and it turned out that they were all working for Mossad. And they gave a press conference, they invited the whole media of the world to say, "Look, we've caught these guys, they're Al-Qaeda and they're working for the Israelis." Nobody took any notice. But that's the reality of the situation.
Polly, what's your take on this? Because I must admit I was quite amazed to hear, and I'm actually quite annoyed that our mainstream press hadn't told us the boss of the Free Syrian Army is actually a Libyan guy.
Well, it's all very confusing for me, to be honest. And I think, you know, we really need to start to ask questions about the independence of what's going on in the Middle East, I suppose. And, you know, Martin's absolutely right with Al-Qaeda. I mean, we funded them in Afghanistan, but the Taliban, and basically, yeah, is a creation of the Western intelligence agencies. And then as a result of the threat of Al-Qaeda, goes back to what we were just talking about before, all our civil liberties are being eroded. So, I mean, yeah, perplexing times.
Yeah, but it's a standard procedure, isn't it? They basically create terrorist opposition, which they control, and then they seize power on the back of the fact that these terrorists are threatening us. It's a scam, just like the financial market stuff is a scam. And basically, ultimately, as Abraham Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people all of the time and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time.
Okay, looking at in the second hour, we're going to be looking at some of the stories from last year or from this year, and also looking ahead to next year. And one of the stories of those stories is to do with this Stuxnet weapon. Now, there's something that's been reported just literally yesterday that the Stuxnet virus that last year damaged Iran's nuclear program was likely one of at least five cyber weapons developed on a single platform whose roots trace back to 2007, according to new research from the Russian computer security firm Kaspersky Lab. Security experts widely believe the US and Israel were behind Stuxnet, though the two nations have officially declined to comment on the matter. A Pentagon spokesman declined to comment again on Kaspersky's research. Stuxnet's already been linked to another virus, the Dooku data stealing Trojan, but far more sophisticated than previously known. Martin, this whole idea of cyber warfare, this Stuxnet is actually aimed at the Iranian nuclear program. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think it was developed. The latest rumor is it was developed at Dimona, which is the Israeli nuclear site, with the Americans and the Israelis working on it jointly. And everybody's quite clear that it's such a sophisticated virus that it's definitely been developed by an intelligence agency. It's not just some random people. But of course, the Stuxnet virus, effective as it was in causing problems for the Iranians, also leaked out. And I've been reading stuff that some people are suggesting that the Fukushima meltdown was as a result of the Stuxnet virus getting inside the Japanese nuclear industry. This is incredibly irresponsible stuff, if you think about it. How irresponsible is it to create viruses which mess up nuclear power stations and then just loosen them on the world? It's just bonkers. And I think people are going, when the history of this period comes to be written, people are going to see how absolutely criminally irresponsible the Western powers
are. But isn't it a legitimate form of attacking another country? What they're saying is, we want to disable your nuclear power station because we don't want you making nuclear weapons.
Well, what if the Iranians were to develop their viruses and put them into our nuclear power stations to mess them up? How would we feel about that? I think we'd be pretty annoyed, wouldn't we?
Okay, Polly, what's your thoughts finally on this topic, on the Stuxnet virus?
Yeah, I think that... Well, I agree with Martin, really. I don't think it's legitimate. And, you know, it's just this kind of double standards again. You know, we've got it domestically, but we've also got it at the international level about, you know, it's fine for us to have nuclear power stations, it's fine for us to have nuclear weapons, but, you know, anyone that we deem a threat or that we don't really like, you know, they can't do it. And I'm just, yeah, I mean, it's the sort of hypocrisy.
Sounds like a breakdown of international law as well as the lack of being prosecution.
Well, this is a criminal offence. And those who were behind it should be sent to prison. That's what ought to happen. Interpol should be on their case.
Okay, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6, and then we'll do our review of last year and look forward to next year after this.
The community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.